Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
For many of us, Parkland Hospital in Dallas is a place we drive by. It's a place to go in an emergency or to visit someone who's sick. Not exactly a place to hang out and think about history, but there is a remarkable history behind Parkland. It's the tale of how a handful of doctors on horseback went from caring for a few sick patients a century ago to treating tens of thousands of North Texans a year. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Parkland's 120-year past is chronicled through a new book by Dr. John Boyd. It's called Parkland Hospital, and it includes dozens of archival photos and is published as part of a series called Images of America. Dr. Boyd, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Lauren. Happy to be here.
So why were you excited to tell Parkland's story?
Well, when I originally was contacted about writing the book, I thought, oh boy, a history book about a hospital, probably not too exciting. And I originally turned down the offer to write the book, but I went back and did some research, and there's some interesting stories about how Parkland got started, how the medical school got started. Of course, there's always the Kennedy role. And at the time, Parkland was involved in what was the largest hospital construction project in the world, building their new hospital. And additionally, the old Parkland campus at Maple and Oak Lawn was undergoing a renovation at the time. So there seemed to be a few interesting stories in there.
And you had a connection to the hospital as well.
Yeah, I went to medical school there from 78 to 82, and then I was a resident at Parkland from 82 to 85.
So you had some personal stories, although they weren't in the book. You didn't get too personal in there.
No, not too many.
So take me back to the beginning of Parkland, to when doctors really were on horseback.
Well, so Parkland was built in 1894, and if you look back in the 1890s, most of the people that could afford it would have doctors come and visit them in their house, and of course the doctors were on horseback at the time. The one city hospital was downtown, in a kind of unsavory part of town. Had a very bad reputation. The Dallas Almanac commented that it was only a place for the penniless and friendless to go. And then in 1894, $40,000 was raised to build the first Parkland, which at the time was a wooden building on the same campus there at Maple and Oak Lawn.
And what did it look like?
That's the picture on the front of the book. It was a two-story wooden house, wooden structure. Had a lobby. The city health director and his family actually lived just off the lobby on the first floor, mostly taking care of poor indigent patients. But they had a second floor that looked more like a hotel where they charged patients to stay.
But they treated them as well, right?
Yes, yes.
So they took both patients who couldn't pay, and there
was a sort of nicer
spot for the people who could. It looks like a large mansion almost, except it's a hospital.
Yes.
What kind of equipment did they have back then?
Well, medicine was undergoing a bit of a transition then. There were some surgical techniques, but, surgery carried a pretty high mortality rate. Much of the equipment was what the doctors brought in with them. Prior to Parkland, the other hospital did not even have nurses on staff there. But when they built the new hospital, it was indeed staffed with nurses.
And at the time, nurses were mostly men, or were they women?
They were women.
Oh, they were.
Almost exclusively, yes.
I see. Now, there's a photo in the book of the city's first ambulance.
Yes.
Describe this.
Yes. It's a horse-drawn carriage, actually. There's kind of a funny statement in there. After a few years, they said that they replaced the metal wheels with rubber tires out of a necessary act of humanity.
So, for the bumpy ride?
Yes.
I mean, I imagine the streets were not exactly paved at that time.
There were very few paved streets, correct.
So did ambulance go and pick people up from their houses when they...
Yeah, it functioned much like ambulances today, just a whole lot slower.
So what was the hospital that opened in 1894 like? It was broken up into wards, right?
There was a separate ward for men, women, children. And you got to remember what era we were in. There was also a separate ward for black citizens.
And how big were the wards? Because it doesn't look like a huge facility.
No. Now, the wards on the first floor were many people were housed in one room. And now upstairs there were private rooms, but downstairs it was several people were all housed in one room.
And what kind of illnesses would people go there for generally?
Well, pretty much the same things we would go to hospitals today for. There was I should point out they opened a separate hospital down the street called Woodland Hospital, and that was more for the contagious type diseases.
Okay.
That's where the tuberculosis type cases would go. And a little later on in the history, that polio, there's a pretty bad polio epidemic in the Texas area, and Parkland was one of the few hospitals equipped to treat polio patients. But that was more towards the 1940s.
Now, what is today Children's Medical Center of Dallas was actually born at Parkland too, as a sort of baby camp. And last year, I reported on its creation for its 100th anniversary. I thought maybe we could listen back to a part of that story. If you rode a wagon down what is now Oak Lawn in April of 1913, you would have passed four large canvas tents. There, beneath the shade of the oak trees, what looked like a campsite was actually the first medical clinic for babies in North Texas. A young nurse named May Forster Smith founded the camp, frustrated that babies were dying, often in hospitals for adults.
People really didn't understand that they weren't just short adults. They really were young babies that had their own very specific medical care needs.
That's Mary Hayes, an archivist with Children's Medical Center. In Texas, infant mortality was high. The Dallas Morning News reported 15 babies died daily. Part of the problem was infectious disease, but the other killer was rotten food, most often milk that would spoil in the hot weather. Hayes says parents would show up at the baby camp with infants severely underweight, 1 6-month-old weighing only 9 pounds.
What they would do is get drops of milk on fingertips and put them on these babies' tongues, and sometimes would have to stroke these babies' throats with their fingers to encourage them to swallow because they were so weak.
May Forster Smith would keep babies weeks, sometimes months, until they were healthy, letting them go only after teaching parents how to keep them from getting sick again. The technology at the baby camp was primitive, but Smith and the other nurses improvised. To keep babies warm, they would heat bricks and wrap them in towels to create a sort of washtub incubator. And then there were the bugs.
The cribs and these incubators might have been put on legs that were then put in tin cans full of water and kerosene designed to keep the ants from crawling up into the incubators.
About 100 babies were treated the first summer, and word spread quickly about the camp's success. In 1915, it moved indoors into a small cottage. But Smith dreamed of a permanent baby hospital in Texas, and it wasn't long before she got a $100,000 donation to open the Bradford Hospital.
And so they come with hope and thankfulness. Volunteer doctors and volunteer workers who consider it a privilege to give their experience, training, and time without any financial remuneration whatsoever.
This hospital for children was a little bit quirky.
The well-meaning architect or designers decided that if this is a hospital for babies, the light switches need to be placed down where babies can turn them on, which is crazy. So the doctors and the nurses found themselves leaning over to turn the light switches off and on.
Hayes says Nurse Smith never married, but did raise babies who'd been abandoned. In the black and white photos, you see a tiny woman, always with unruly hair.
Every time I look at him, I have to smile because I just think she looked in the mirror once in the morning, maybe, and then she never looked in the mirror again. She was too busy and had other more important things to do.
When Smith got pneumonia in 1938, she refused to stop working. She died in the hospital she created, surrounded by the nurses she had trained. But her vision lived on. Bradford became Children's Medical Center, a place where kids could go for the newest life-saving surgeries. Back then, Dr. Boyd, once you hit a certain age, were you supposed to go to Parkland, or were you, did they keep children separate from adults in the beginning?
Actually, Parkland continued to take care of children up until sometime in the 50s, at which time, now that the age cutoff has changed throughout history, but I believe they treated anyone under the age of 12, they would have them go to Children's. Now, Parkland did continue to run a pediatric burn unit for quite some time after that.
And today, if you're above 12, what's the age limit for when you switch from Children's in Dallas to Parkland?
I'm not sure. I think it is somewhere around the age of 12, but it varies from hospital to hospital and even from year to year. So
yeah, it's interesting. Some of the people that we profiled in KERA's series, Growing Up After Cancer, when I talked with them, people who had a relapse of cancer that had originally occurred when they were children would actually go back to Children's in their 20s, sort of for a consistency of care.
Yeah, and there are certain diseases that pediatric oncologists are better at treating than adult oncologists. So that would make sense if it was a pediatric cancer to stay with a pediatric oncologist.
So what happened with that, with the very first Parkland, the building?
Well, so it had only been open for about 15 years. And again, this is at a time when medical techniques and medical knowledge was rapidly changing. And within 15 years, the Dallas County Medical Society determined the original Parkland to be no longer adequate, no longer sanitary, unsafe against wind and fire. And so in 1913, they built a brick building to replace that. And that's the building that still stands today at Maple and Oak Lawn. Now, the old Parkland, the old wooden Parkland actually did stay open a few more years. But again, like they predicted, eventually it burned to the ground.
Oh, so really?
It's no longer there.
How did, well, just an accident?
Well, it was an all wooden structure and,
I guess you don't build hospitals out of wood anymore.
No.
How has the construction material changed of Parkland over time? It went from wood to brick to...
Well, in 1955, they built the brick structure over there on Harry Hines, the original Harry Hines Parkland Hospital. And, of course, you've seen the new facility, which is kind of a more high-tech, a lot of glass used in the exterior of the building.
Was there any concerns with that, with, I don't know, going from brick to using so much glass?
Well, actually, that is a very specialized glass that allows natural light to come in, as well as there's a nice design feature. You can see they've etched the names of the people that donated money to the Parkland Foundation, and the way they etched their names in glass, it makes it look like a large tree on the side of the building.
Huh. Was there much decoration for the second Parkland, I guess, the Parkland that was the brick building?
A decoration in terms of inside. It had a, for its time, it was designed by, I believe, Herbert Green, and it was a very elegant building for its time. Had nicely landscaped lawns, and the word parkland comes from the fact that it was built in a former park, and so it had large trees around it, and but not so much decoration on the inside.
But that's been consistent, or at least it's been an attempt to make it consistent with the idea of the park.
And it's still a theme today. The design team that built the new Parkland was asked to create an atmosphere of a hospital within a park.
And how'd they do that?
It's nicely landscaped. They have a couple of different outdoor gardens, and there's another garden they haven't yet completed that's going to honor President Kennedy. So, yeah, they've done a nice job landscaping.
I didn't know the name Parkland came from that. Interesting. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. And we're talking about Parkland's 120-year past that history is chronicled through photography and writings in a new book by Dr. John W. Boyd. He is a Dallas doctor. It's called Parkland Hospital. And you can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372, by emailing think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back to talk more about the history of Parkland and take your questions after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
Thing took place here. and people lived and died here.
It provided care for those people who otherwise would not have had it.
The teachers were dedicated, the war was on, people were dying.
So many of these young physicians had been through the war, making do with nothing in order to accomplish what they needed to.
People learned here.
This is Think from KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. Those were former residents and nurses reminiscing on the old Parkland of the 1950s or so. This hour, we're talking with Dallas doctor John Boyd about the 120-year history of Parkland. His new book of photography features some images that are published for the first time. Dr. Boyd, how did Parkland and UT Southwestern establish their relationship?
Well, before there was UT Southwestern, the predominant medical school in Dallas was actually the Baylor College of Medicine. The Baylor College of Medicine had a contract with Parkland to provide 50% of the hospital staff. And it's kind of interesting. Baylor and Parkland made plans to move to Harry Hines to build a new medical center in the 1950s. And as they were drawing the plans up, there became some issues between a private religious medical school combining finances and location with a public hospital. And in April of 1943, Baylor suddenly announced they were leaving town and would be going to Houston, where they still are today. So all of a sudden, Dallas found itself without a medical school. There was the Southwest Medical Foundation was started by a Dr. Carey, and along with Carl Hoblitzell and some others in 1939. And they decided that they would open up a medical school. And it is amazing what they did in such a short period of time. They found an abandoned old Dallas Public Junior High School. They bought some acreage next to Parkland. They enrolled 277 students. They got local doctors to donate textbooks and medical journals. And they actually opened up a new medical school called Southwestern Medical School that fall. And it was given an A rating, so it was ranked as high as Harvard and some other schools at the time.
But there, at some points, there were shortages of nurses then and medical students, I imagine.
But they actually had an abundance right then.
Okay.
And they actually graduated 61 new doctors the following year. So it's just amazing what Dr. Carey and others were managed to put together in such a short period of time.
There is a photo in the book that I think that's what I'm referring to, of British nurses.
Yes. Well,
when was that? They had to bring in nurses from England?
That was in the 1960s. And I'm not sure what all was going on to create the nursing shortage for Parkland, but their answer to the problem, yes, was to bring in, as you can see from the picture, quite a few nurses from England to help staff the hospital.
Now, there's you were a resident there, though, in the 70s, right?
From 82 to 85.
82
yes.
to 85. And so you were in the building that is what we call the old Parkland on Harry Hines.
It's the original hospital on Harry Hines. It's often difficult to talk about all the many different Parkland buildings because at some point in the past, every one of them was new Parkland. And at some point in the future, every one of them is going to be the old Parkland.
That's exactly.
Yeah, I was at the original Parkland on Harry Hines, which is now just closed a couple months ago.
And right before you got there, there was some sound that we found that was about what was then the new Parkland of the 50s.
They got air conditioning for the surgery suites, but even at that time, they had to open the windows and the doctors would operate in their underwear and just try to stay as cool as they could.
That was Dr. John Denman, who was a student at Parkland Hospital in 1955 and 1956. When you were there a few decades after, did it still feel new?
It was an up-to-date hospital, and by the time I got there, we no longer had to operate in our underwear, so things had improved a little
fortunate
bit.
Or fortunate, I don't know. I couldn't imagine waking up on the table and seeing my doctor doing operation in the underwear. Were people, though, at that time sort of starting to clamor and say, we need more space, or we need more this, or we need more that?
Well, In 1964, Parkland had a major expansion, and again in 1981, they had a major expansion. So they kept up with the physical needs during that period of time.
Now, despite all of the history that's been made at Parkland, there's one day that's forever tied to the hospital. Of course, that's November 22nd, 1963. What did you, as a resident, when you were there later, still feel like that moment had an impact?
Everyone recognized that what had taken place. Now, in 1973, the hospital went through another major renovation, and the old emergency room was actually destroyed and is now the radiology department. So the famous trauma room one was no longer there.
Where President Kennedy was treated. Yeah. There's a photo of that trauma room in your book of trauma room one. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what it looked like? Where President Kennedy was treated?
Well, it was, for its time, it was a modern emergency room. But if you look at it today, it had a bare amount of equipment, a small gurney in the middle of the room, and not much else.
Yeah, it looks like there's a metal tray for the surgical equipment and a very small gurney. But that wasn't there when you were there.
No, that... No, that room actually has kind of a bit of interesting history, because when they knew they were going to demolish that section of the hospital, they contacted the Smithsonian to see if they wanted to acquire that room and all the original contents that were there the day Kennedy was treated there. They contacted the National Archives, and the National Archives came and removed that room and all its contents, packed it into crates and boxes, and stored it in the National Archives in Fort Worth. In 2006, I believe, it was moved to the underground salt mine storage facility up in Lenexa, Kansas, and it's not to be seen, not to be shown to the public, so it's just hidden away in the National Archives.
Wow, so it hasn't been revealed to the public at all?
No, I think there's a handful of investigators that have allowed access to it, but other than that, it's probably never going to be seen. There's one picture in the book a few days before they removed Trauma Room 1. An ambulance driver went and removed the number one sign from the door. And he just recently came forward and donated that to the Sixth Floor Museum. So that's probably all anyone will ever see of Trauma Room 1.
Interesting. Now, someone who was there at the time in 1963 on that day, this is a recording of him, Dr. Red Duke.
I heard the chairman of surgery, Paige Stat. Well, that was unheralded. I went over to answer the phone. Well, another fellow got there first. I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "Well, the president's been shot."
That was Red Duke, who was a fourth-year surgery resident on duty at Parkland when President Kennedy was rushed there back in that day. Now, a few pages after the photo of Trauma Room 1, where President Kennedy was treated, there's another photo of Lee Harvey Oswald on a cot.
Yes, there's one picture of Lee Harvey Oswald being brought to the Parkland emergency room. What's interesting is you may recognize the man standing next to him as Officer Jim Lavelle, who was the same person that was handcuffed to Oswald when he got shot in the basement of the police department. By the way, he's still around today, and I had a chance to meet him, and he helped dedicate the new Kennedy Memorial at the new Parkland Hospital just a week or two ago. Then there's another photograph of Lee Harvey Oswald actually in surgery at Parkland Hospital.
Now, was he in surgery in the same space that the president was?
No. Now, he was treated in Trauma Room 2, which is where Connolly was treated. And then he went
up to the governor,
yes.
who was wounded but not killed.
Yes. And Oswald actually died in surgery on the upstairs an hour or so later. So,
was there anything done to collect and to store what was left of Trauma Room 2 like there was with Trauma Room 1 or no?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So that was sort of brushed aside.
Yes.
Understandably. So in the 1960s, doctors at Parkland were actually making pretty incredible medical advances. Also, there's a photo showing one from 1968, a team of doctors with surgical masks and scalpels. They're leaning over a patient. What are they doing there?
Now, there's a couple of pictures. There's, Parkland's had a lot of firsts.
Yeah.
They had one of the first kidney transplants, successful kidney transplants in Texas. There's another photograph of the first female heart transplant that's ever taken place. It was also the site of one of the first corneal transplants. So Parkland has had quite a few firsts in its time.
How did it manage to do that? I mean, as a public hospital, you don't think of it as having the resources to make such strides in medicine.
Well, again, that's where the affiliation with the UT Southwestern comes in. UT Southwestern has always been committed to patient care, medical education, and medical research. So they're always kind of on the cutting edge, and they remain there today.
So more than 10,000 babies a year are delivered at Parkland these days. When did the hospital become known or, I don't know, become such a hot spot for giving birth?
Well, they developed one of the first neonatal nurseries in the country. Even from the earliest days, they recruited a Dr. William Mengert, who is one of the most one of the more famous OB-GYN doctors in the country. So they've had a commitment to OB-GYN services ever since the inception.
Now, Dr. Boyd, the hospital, Parkland, has also been in the middle of the controversy or the political debate over immigration over the years because of many of the mothers, for example, who have babies there had been unable or are unable to provide proof of citizenship. How has Parkland's reputation changed and how has it stood in sort of the public light over time?
Well, when I was there, we certainly took care of a large portion of immigrants whose status was unknown to the people treating them. So now I'm speaking in the past, that was never an issue. Once they got in the front door of the hospital, they were treated the same, whether they were here legally, illegally, whether they had finances to pay for the bills or whether they didn't. So there's a whole host of different patients we see there.
But has the reputation of the hospital from the public, I mean, you said when Parkland was first started, it was seen as probably many hospitals were as a place for people who didn't have family to come care for them, for the penniless, for the people who couldn't afford health care. Is that still, you think, how people see Parkland today?
Well, they still fulfill that role, but I think they're also known as a first world-class medical center, and they attract many patients besides just those that can't pay for their care. I should point out, in addition to Parkland, another major hospital that just opened up is the Clements Hospital just up the street on Harry Hines, which is a UT Southwestern teaching hospital.
And how different is Clements, which is a new hospital, just like the brand new Parkland? How different are those hospitals?
Parkland's certainly a larger facility. Clements, being a part of the UT Southwestern medical system, actually has more space dedicated to research and education than Parkland does. But they're both beautiful state-of-the-art facilities.
Yeah, they are. Mm-hmm. And they have some high-tech – both of them have features that you would never have seen just a decade ago or so.
Correct.
So as the Parkland Hospital system grew over the years, it expanded and it opened community clinics as well. There aren't photos of those in the book, but what can you tell us about the community clinics?
Well, I forget the total number of buildings that Parkland still maintains, even though they've shut down their primary Harry Hines Hospital and reopened across the street. There's still a surgery center on Harry Hines. There's several women clinics throughout the city, some mental health clinics throughout the city, as well as some mobile care units that vans that deliver healthcare, vans, you can get a mammography and other things.
Have you visited any of the community clinics or did when you were a resident, did you go to any of those?
When I was a resident, there were not nearly as many as there are today. And also as a resident of Parkland, you tend to go to other affiliated hospitals, Children's, Scottish Rite, the VA, St. Paul. So you go to several different facilities, but there are much more outpatient clinics today than there were back then.
What are your memories of Parkland from your residency there? What stands out?
It was a lot of work. It was a little bit of a different world. I think today the residents are only allowed to work a certain number of hours per week, and that rule didn't exist back in the day. So we would put in some fairly significant hours, the medical school is fairly rigorous. Usually your first 2 years are in the classroom and your second 2 years you spend a good bit of time over at Parkland. There's some there's some good memories. There's some a lot of camaraderie. But one thing interesting about medical school and residency, you know that it's only there for a finite period of time, and then you kind of say goodbye to everyone that you spent the last 4 years working with. So we all kind of go our separate way at the end of residency.
Did you ever go back to Parkland after you completed residency?
Yeah, Parkland does a real good job at putting on what they call grand rounds or teaching rounds that they invite the medical community in addition to the residents at Parkland. So there's quite a few educational opportunities available to the medical community there.
And have you visited the new Parkland?
I have, yes, yes. I got to visit it once during construction. I was also there on what they called the grand opening for the public before patients moved in. And then I made it back down there for opening day to get a picture of the first patient being transferred across the sky bridge from the old Parkland to the new Parkland.
Which must have been sort of a photo, everyone trying to get a photo of that for the first patient and the last patient.
Yes, yes. But, you know, for patient privacy laws, you can't really just take a picture of the patient. So mine's a view from outside the hospital looking in through the glass sky bridge of the patient coming over from Parkland.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We're talking about the history of Parkland. Our guest today is Dallas Dr. John Boyd. He's author of the new book, Parkland Hospital. It's a book mostly of photographs that tells the story of the healthcare giant Parkland, which actually started 120 years ago. If you've got questions about Parkland's history, maybe you've been there as a patient or visiting friends or family and want to know more about its architecture or its design or its past, please give us a call. You can join the conversation. 800-933-5372 is the phone number, or you can email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman, and we'll be back with more from Dr. John Boyd after a quick break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
IT manager Joe Longo calls the new Parkland a digital hospital, totally wireless and integrated. A Parkland one-of-a-kind super-sized flat screen is in each room and can pull up medical records, show x-rays, allow patients to check email, order meals, and watch TV. Judy Harrington is a vice president of nursing.
All the new rooms at the hospital are all private rooms, which is a huge improvement from our old facility where we had a lot of semi-private rooms, the bulk. So these rooms are about 40% bigger than our old Parkland rooms.
And all of them have a view of downtown. Last year, there were 10,000 births at Parkland. Director of Obstetrics, Dr. Brian Casey, says new high-tech labor and delivery rooms will keep mom, baby, and family together. No more waiting in the hallway for a delivery room.
Only given the expansion from the 30 labor rooms that we currently have to the now 44 labor and delivery rooms, we anticipate that there will be no cause for having women labor in the halls anymore.
Dallas County sold bonds to pay for about 75% of new Parkland. Savings and private donations fill the gap. Taxpayers approved those bonds in 2008, agreeing to add about 3 cents to the hospital district tax rate.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. That was a peek inside the new Parkland Hospital, reporting by BJ Austin. Of course, we say the new Parkland Hospital, which has been said several times, each about 50 years apart, because there have been how many creations, Dr. Boyd, of Parkland?
Well, this will be the fourth time they've moved into a new building. although it's only the third campus, because the first two Parklands actually occupied the same campus.
I see. And this hour we're talking with Dr. Boyd. He's the guide through a new book of photography of Parkland from way back in 1894, when it was a wooden building in a meadow in Dallas, to today's $1.3 billion reincarnation. What elements of the new Parkland are consistent with former Parkland hospitals?
Well, they've all had emergency rooms. They've all had operating rooms. They've all had patient rooms. Of course, as we heard in that little episode, the rooms are all now private, which is a little unusual for a public hospital. The labor delivery rooms are relatively new, but they had them at the previous Parkland as well.
What about the design elements? What's consistent either architecturally or with the elements used or the materials?
You know, it's a whole different look over there today. As they said, almost all rooms have an outside view, many of them looking over downtown. All the rooms have a nurse's station directly outside of them where the nurse can do her necessary electronic medical work record in close proximity to the patient. But it's old Parkland, the 1955 old Parkland was definitely showing its age. So this is a vast improvement.
Did they move anything besides the patients over to the new Parkland, either equipment or furniture or anything?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of equipment. And then there were some just other artifacts, some of the elements from the meditation room or the chapel was moved over there. The old Kennedy memorial was moved over there. So, and quite a bit of equipment. And there's still, even though there's no active inpatient care going on at the old Parkland, there's still some business functions that take place over there. There's still some outpatient clinics over there. So
administrative and yeah. Also. And I saw, I think that in the book you say that there's actually some stained glass from the 1954 hospital that's in the new Parkland.
Yeah, I think that's in the what they call now the meditation room or the chapel, yeah.
And they just wanted to save that and not throw it
yes.
out, I guess.
Yeah.
How does the design of New Parkland stand out? What's unorthodox looking back?
Well, it's kind of two large buildings cantilevered on top of each other. It's 17 stories. It's it flows very nicely when you're inside. One section I wasn't able to photograph is they actually have one ward, which is basically the jail of Parkland. So when they have inmates that need treatment, that's where they're housed.
How long does that go back? Because that's at the old Parkland, they treat inmates as well. So when did that start?
You know, so I had some photographs of the early 1955 Parkland that did have jail cells.
Now, actual jail cells.
Yes. Now, when I was there in the 80s, there were no jail cells. They still treated inmates, but they were either the handcuff or a leg cuff attached to their beds, and there was usually a officer outside the door. So
that's fascinating. And when did, if you know, did Parkland Hospital and Health System have its own police? They have their own police sort of force that keeps everything safe on the campus. Was that there when you were there in the 80s?
Well, the police were certainly there. Whether they were a Parkland force or part of the Dallas Police Department, I'm not certain at that time. But
Has the safety measures, have those changed a lot over the years? I don't know if you know what they were like back in the 50s compared to today.
Yes. Well, I got to hear the sound of a gunshot at Parkland ER once when I was there. So, it's a county hospital and some pretty rough clients come in there. But I think the security is much improved today.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess you get all kinds of people coming into the lobby. What stories did you uncover while doing the research for this book about Parkland that surprised you?
Well, again, we kind of visited the story about how the medical school got started basically from scratch. The other kind of interesting story that doesn't directly involve Parkland is what's going on there at the old Parkland campus at Maple and Oak Lawn. When Parkland moved in 1955, they kept that open as a medical center, although it was mostly for psychiatric and infectious disease type treatment. And it completely closed in the 70s, and it was turned over to Dallas County. The county ran a minimum security prison, a police training academy, a fire marshal, a rape crisis center, and even a drug rehab center out of that place for several years. Those services finally got transferred to other county facilities, and it completely closed. They put a fence around it, and it basically got taken over by the homeless and graffiti artists for quite some time. Parkland, they repurchased the building with the hopes of turning it back into a patient care facility, I believe in 1994, but plans never materialized. And so once again, it's closed down. And in 2006, Harlan Crow Holdings bought it. And it's just done a magnificent job at restoring both the original Parkland Hospital as well as the 1921 nurses' quarters over there. And since then, he's added several new structures in the same architectural style.
What is that style? It's gorgeous, the bricks. And
yeah, they call it Jeffersonian.
With the columns and the... Uh-huh.
Very much has a feel and look of a college campus.
Yes, of a back east college mm-hmm. campus. But it was the hospital. And I've noticed over the years that it's revealed itself more, I guess, from that. When was it fenced up?
Well, throughout the—after the county stopped using it.
Okay.
And the county didn't stop in one day. They just replaced each of those— activities at other locations. So it's probably in the 90s they fenced it up and stayed that way until Crow took it over in about 2006.
You're listening to Think on KERA. We're talking about Parkland Hospital and its history, a new book by Dr. Boyd about the history of Parkland starting 120 years ago. Dennis in North Oak Cliff, you there?
Hi, yes. I have told a few folks that the little green wooden structure attached to the basement of the old Parkland along Oak Lawn was the ER where they took Kennedy, and I'm thinking now I was wrong, and maybe that's where they took me at least a decade earlier. And I wondered what the true story is.
Let's get it for you. What's the true story, Dr. Boyd?
Yeah, Kennedy was taken to the... what I'll call the original hospital on Harry Hines, which was built about 1955. That was where Parkland was in 1963.
But there's still some confusion about that. I wonder why. Because I've looked up the same thing. I'm confused about which of the Parklands was he brought to.
Yeah, several people are. Once again, I think it's because we use the same name for four different structures. Originally, when Parkland moved to Harry Hines, they renamed the old Parkland Woodland Hospital to try and avoid that confusion, but that name didn't seem to hold on very well.
Yeah, I guess not. So why look back at this? What's important about telling the story of this more than a century history of Parkland Hospital?
Well, when I was a medical student there and I'd walk through the Carey building and the Hoblitzell building, I didn't know who any of those people were. And it turns out there's some larger-than-life characters who made sacrifices and helped create Southwestern Medical School whose names just aren't known to a lot of people. Carl Hoblitzell was... His family ran the Interstate Amusement Company, and he opened the Majestic Theater in downtown Dallas. And he was one of the early businessmen that helped create the new medical center on Harry Hines, donated a tremendous amount of time and energy, and he actually became the head of the Southwest Medical Foundation after Dr. Carey died in the 1950s.
So you wanted to tell it so that people could learn a little bit about who these people were.
Yes. And there's some interesting stories as well as it's – I tried to look at the Kennedy era as through the eyes of Parkland Hospital. So my book kind of focuses on, what went on at Parkland and why things happened as they did. And
did doctors, when you were there in the 80s, still talk about that a lot, about what happened with the president and his treatment?
Yes. Yeah, so most of – for example, I was an anesthesiology resident, and both the chairman of the department, Dr. Jenkins, as well as Dr. Giesecke, were both active in treating Kennedy and as well as Connolly. So most of the heads of departments when I was training there were people that that were there in 1963.
And so. In what tone did they talk about what had happened?
You know, just like Dallas has kind of gone through a period of feeling shame about it, to then now I think they look upon it more as it's their obligation to help preserve that part of history. A lot of the doctors didn't like to talk about it. In fact, if you talk to the curators down at the Sixth Floor Museum, it was quite a few years before doctors wanted to sit down and make a voice recording about their memories about what happened that day. So it was something that wasn't talked about too much.
Now, Parkland also has a unique history association with astronauts, with NASA astronauts.
Well, they do. And
with training, at least, right?
I wasn't aware of that, but they do have a, aerospace medicine and I think I have a photograph of three different physicians who went on to become astronauts. There's another lady, Mary Weber, I believe, who didn't train at Parkland, but after completing her career as a NASA astronaut, she became affiliated with the biochemistry department down there. So,
what other high-profile people have been treated at Parkland?
What other high-profile people? There's certainly mayors have been treated there.
People have been brought there though in many emergencies, from tornadoes to there aren't earthquakes out here, but it's been the spot that's been the sort of first responder in terms of hospitals for many crises in North Texas.
Yes, and among many other things, they have one of the largest civilian burn units in the country, actually.
And when was that created?
That was started by Dr. Charlie Baxter, I think, in the early 60s. I think it was around 1962 that it was started.
So do you expect there to be another new Parkland in 50 or so years, since that seems to be the trend?
That does indeed seem to be the trend. And again, I think Parkland's a little unusual. Most large hospitals tend to just add on. But I think at some point Parkland realized that they were running out of room to add on, and it was time for a major change.
So no. So you think they won't add on? They'll build it again?
I think they have quite a bit of room across the street to add on for at least another 50 years.
I hope so. That would be one less new Parkland to refer to and get confused with the old Parkland.
That's right.
Dr. John Boyd is an anesthesiologist in Dallas. He's also author of Parkland Hospital. It's part of Arcadia Publishing's series, Images of America. It includes photographs from the history of Parkland from more than a century ago. Dr. Boyd, thank you for coming in.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and you can contact us at email think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.